My name's Chris Hewitt. I've been a journalist for nearly 50 years. And my background is I started off on local papers. Then I specialised in IT and business stories. And I've known about Jimmy Savile. There were rumours about him in the 1960s. I had the story firmed up on him in 1978. And
tell us what you mean by firmed up. I mean, we used to call it, can you stand a story up? There's such rumours going around the whole time. But we as journalists, what we try and do is try and, you know, stand those stories up or firm them up before they get near to getting into print.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I mean, the story stood up. I had people in the music business, including Pete Waterman, confirmed the stories about Savile.
Okay, can you just take us from the rumours to actually getting it all firmed up?
Right. Well, when I was a student, started off at the local tech in 1969, obviously,
Is that in Coventry?
I was in Coventry Technical College, yeah. In 1969, we looked at booking DJs for, you know, the May Ball and things like that, and somebody suggested Savile, and contacts in the music business said don't touch him. He said they want to know how old the girls were who started the tech, and I said they're 16, and this contact of mine said he likes them younger than that.
Right, so that's a rumour.
Yeah, and certainly when I went to uni, there were similar rumours going around then, and I met journalists over the years who tried to expose Savile, but again, nobody was interested. I did manage to get Pete Waterman to firm it up, and that was in 1978.
Okay, so what did he say?
Oh, he confirmed that Savile was a paedophile.
Right, amazing. So at that point, you're starting to think, well, these rumours from college, now I'm a journalist, maybe we should get this out there.
Yeah, it should do, yeah. And, when I approached some of the nationals, they just were not interested. And then I started doing a bit more digging, and I found out that Savile had been arrested on at least six occasions for offences against underage girls. Yep. On each and every occasion, he'd been released on the orders of Special Branch.
Oh, so do you know where he was arrested, when roughly?
No, but he said this was prior to 1978. He'd been nicked at least six times.
So, and where did you get that information from?
Well, I have police contacts.
Yeah.
Because the West Midlands Vice Squad would like to have seen him locked up as well.
Oh, okay. So there were elements within the police that were trying to, you know, back in the 70s, trying to prosecute him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So he'd be, how did it work? He'd be lifted by the police, people make accusations, and then just let go.
Well, Special Branch specifically ordered him to be released.
Can you explain who Special Branch are for people that don't understand?
Well, the Special Branch was originally set up in Victorian times to keep an eye on the Republican side in Ireland, because they're actually known as the Special Irish Branch. But now they're interested in security issues.
Mm. Every force has its special branch officers, doesn't it? They seem to get very much involved in things like political policing. I was interviewed by special branch officers when I had death threats from the Jewish Defence League, for example.
Yeah. And so with the Vice Squad, because they knew he couldn't keep his hands to himself.
So, I mean, how does it work when somebody like the Vice Squad can't actually pursue prosecutions for pedophilia? I mean, that's their bread and butter, surely.
That's right, absolutely right. Well, Special Branch ordered Savile's release on at least six occasions. Now, the only reason I can think that why that would happen is because he was an intelligence asset. See, MI5 has long been paranoid about the BBC, all these liberal programme makers were taking Moscow gold and all this sort of nonsense.
What you've done is you've put in my mind this whole idea of police infiltrators, police sources, you know, the people who are sent out to infiltrate gangs and things, almost talking about Savile as somebody like that, who's he's a confidential source for the police.
Well, I think it was more to do with the fact that he was a source for MI5. Mm. By the way, in police infiltration is nowhere near as common as the conspiracy theorists say, because frankly they don't have the officers.
So how does that work with MI5? What's the implications of that? Because they're like military intelligence, aren't they?
Well, they don't gather a military. They actually deal with security of the state. But the MI5 have always had, well, I don't know about now, but certainly in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, they had a certain paranoia about people who worked for the BBC, and the belief was that, the KGB had heavily infiltrated it.
So what are you suggesting, that he was a sort of a political informer for MI5 at the BBC?
Yes, almost, yes. That's the only thing I could think of. You know, he was what was called an asset.
Amazing, really. I mean, yeah. I mean, this relationship with Prince Charles, now King Charles, is a pretty weird one. I mean, the suggestion is that Savile just completely conned Charles. It does seem like that's a bit of a difficult thing to do, because Charles knew him for a very long time, and surely mm-hmm. would have been aware of all these rumours and these arrests, for example.
No, if that's only if the special branch told him.
Ah.
Yeah, but Savile knew a lot of people, because he used the cover of his charity work. That's why he was able to get close to the good and the great. I mean, it's certainly true that he did raise a hell of a lot of money for charity.
Yeah. Okay, so overall, were you surprised when Savile died that these things then began to trickle out? Because even the BBC after Savile's death, I mean, obviously, you know, journalists understand that unless it's gone through the courts, it's very difficult to criticise these celebrities, because they'll come for you in a libel case.
That's right, yes. I think a lot more journalists knew about it, but it was actually down to, but there are quite a few Fleet Street editors who hate the BBC. Oh, for example, I was very surprised the Daily Mail hadn't run the story.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost an obvious thing for them to do when they pick up something like that.
And Murdoch also does a lot of the BBC. Again, I'm surprised the Murdoch papers didn't go for Savile.
Well, Bill Oddie's on the record as saying that the only reason Savile wasn't prosecuted is because Charles was protecting him. Charles was a character reference.
Charles would only be able to comment on his work for charity. No, but he wasn't being protected by Charles. The royal family is a lot doesn't have anything like that amount of influence. They certainly couldn't influence decisions not to prosecute him.
Anyway, I mean, I think, you know, you've done a tremendous amount of work over the years.
Yeah.
Chris, with your, you know, you've also, you know, been on this program talking about the Birmingham pub bombings, etc.
Yeah.
And I was kind of shocked to hear that there was some sort of Rule 24 complaint by another journalist against you through the Journalists Union. Can you just tell us about that whole process and what it was about, please?
Well, one of the worst kept secrets in the West Midlands is that Warwick University, or Warwick PLC as we all call it, was giving priority to rich Chinese students over better qualified British students. And that was deemed to be racist, when all we do is it was a question of fact. It was racist for me to say that. Well, 4 months after they started throwing me out of the union, the Sunday Times ran the story on the front page. And the Sunday Times wouldn't run a story like that without triple-checking it.
Wondering, you know, who could construe a story like that as racist? So you're saying effectively that students from China, because they're paying more money, are being selected to go to Warwick, rather than people who are equally or better qualified who are paying them less money? That seems to me like a simple question about the ethics of the running of the university.
Well, yes, and absolutely right, and a lot of more and more universities are seeing Chinese students as a milch cow, and I think it's a very dangerous oversight. You see, one thing I can tell you about overseas students: if they come from wealthy homes, their parents expect them to get a degree. That's why a lot of them don't work as hard as they should do. Cambridge is the only university to date that has said that overseas students who don't do the work will get chucked out. If they fail their exams, they'll be shown the door.
Yeah, I mean, there's a temptation, isn't there, for these universities just simply to be looking at the bottom line rather than academic excellence.
They've been looking at that for a very long time, I'm afraid. Warwick was the first one to sell its soul, but you find there's a lot more. Because universities have overextended themselves financially. I mean, I'd love to know how many universities are actually getting close to being in serious financial difficulties. Universities will go bankrupt. I mean, we've got about, was it 145 universities when perhaps we only need 30?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the idea is that there's less jobs out there since the manufacturing has all collapsed.
And that's right.
So we've got to keep people in education for much longer, even if they're learning virtually nothing or they're learning nonsense.
Well, one in four graduates have never used their degrees. That's been the case for 100-plus years. But no, the theory is that I've heard this one, that they're being kept in because it's keeps them off the unemployment figures. But that is a very expensive way of doing it. Now, if you want to get young people into real jobs with real training, what we should have done, which Thatcher refused to do, was to bring our training laws into line with Germany. Because I don't mean this, when an apprenticeship contract is very difficult to enforce legally. You know, they could make you spend your 5 years just making the tea. But if we had German style apprenticeships for 5 years, industry would very quickly create 500,000 real jobs, not stacking supermarket shelves, and that would get a lot of people into real jobs, into real work. So when they decided to move on to another employer, they got real experience on their CV.
So can you just take us through this process? Because, I mean, you're one of the best journalists I know, Chris. You're very articulate. You've got a lot of experience. You've got integrity. In other words, you're prepared to push a story, even if it might not be popular with an editor. What happened?
One of the persons felt insulted about what I was saying. So I apologised to her because... unlike some of Fleet Street's finest, I don't have an ego problem with apologising. They accepted that I'd apologised adequately, and that the case was withdrawn. I was very close to resigning from the union, because that's not how you treat your members who pay the fight for people's paying conditions. It was only because I had some very good members in Coventry and Birmingham who persuaded me not to resign and carry on and keep up the fight.
I mean, but the thing is, you've apologised for something which, you're saying, I'm sorry it was racist, but it wasn't...
No, I did say it was sorry racist. I said I was sorry that they felt upset by what I'd said.
But
the Sunday Times, about 4 months later, the Sunday Times ran the story on the front page. It's over 5 years ago, but I think it was along the lines that Warwick was giving preference to rich Chinese students. Now, we see, the reason why we invite Chinese students over here goes right back to the 1960s. My late father was a project manager at Courtauld, and Courtauld used to do what we now call design and build, where they go to a country and they'd offer their design... build and procure, design a man-made fibres factory, procure all the equipment, supervise his building, get the workers trained up to do it. And when he was in China, Lan Chao, this was in the middle of the Cultural Revolution, he took a letter from Coventry's, from one of Coventry's senior Labour people, who was one of the founders of the party, called George Hoskinson. And he gave that to Chou Enlai, the Chinese premier, inviting them to send undergraduates to Lanchester Polytechnic and Warwick University. And Premier Chou said, we will, but this is not the right time. And this is where they're coming from. And there are far too many universities just seeing overseas students as milch cows. You know, it's an easy few thousand quid they're going to get off them. But I mean, soon as British students had to start paying fees, that fundamentally changed the attitude of most people towards university education. Because I'm actually surprised that more undergraduates don't sue their universities for some of the rubbish courses that are being offered.
Well, some of them have been, certainly during COVID, saying that the quality of education was appalling.
Well, certainly at Warwick, a lot of Warwick students are very angry that they were having to rely on lectures which are delivered over via their laptops. Because obviously, if you're all in the same room, it's perfectly possible to have a lecture as long as you observe the isolation rules of 6 foot between each student. But you see, if you're going in a room full of people, somebody might think of a question that you haven't thought of. And it's easy. A lot of people do not like speaking over laptops or on TV. But they certainly got a lot of flack for that. And as I said, universities are going to go bankrupt, and that's why it's a false economy too.
I don't know if you're aware of a story at Warwick University about 20 years ago with this senior philosophy lecturer, Nick Land, being booted out. He was one of the senior Nietzschean philosophy lecturer for feeding LSD to his students and trying to conjure demons. I don't know if you come across that one, Chris, have you?
No, I didn't. Partly the problem is that people do not like criticising. There's too many editors who don't like criticising universities. I mean, it's like if you go back to the 60s and 70s, the editor of the Oxford Evening Mail refused to run stories critical of the university, unless there was a court case. Yeah. I mean, this is incidentally the reason why the satirical magazine Private Eye was founded, because Richard Ingram and his friends could see that there were stories the local paper ought to be covering, which never were.
Well, we've certainly got the same in Bristol, Chris.
There
is a newspaper, thank God, the Anarchist Bristolian, which does print those stories and, for example, does cartoons, which are very critical of the establishment in the city. And I think without it, a city, without a paper like that, a city really, it is almost like it doesn't have a heart. So a story that an editor will reject because it's critical of the establishment needs to find an outlet somewhere.
Oh, I agree. I was told this by a senior Panorama journalist, in about 1975, because I said I've got this story which I can't get published. He said, do you agree I've got a duty to go to papers that work for? He says, yes, you have, and I would do exactly the same, even if I got flack from my own management. You know, and I mean, I think the danger with the other big danger with the big expansion in universities is these number of halls of residence, which is specially built for journalists, and you know, and some of them, they're openly advertised as luxury flats or luxury digs, and that means there's a danger that they're going to be in the same position that big cities like Coventry and Bristol had, where they reliant on just one or two industries.
Well, I mean, you've been a journalist for longer than me, quite a lot longer, actually, Chris. Can you just sum up in a nutshell the changes you've seen in the profession over the years?
If you're going back, when I was first interested in journalism, which was in the late 50s when I was in the junior school, I think the difference was that most journalists came from working homes. That is always impossible for any journalist to come from blue-collar background to get into journalism, because there's too many editors who think that you've had a good education if you've been to a private school, which is often not the case.
So is it?
And that's the worst one. I think the other big problem is that you've got the elimination of competitive papers. I mean, most big cities used to have two evening newspapers. I mean, was it the Bristol Journal, wasn't it?
We had the Evening World and the Evening Post. The Evening World was owned by Northcliffe. The Post was locally owned.
Yeah. I know. And is that, even if you've got a weekly paper that isn't owned by the main publisher, it still picks up stories. I mean, when I started out professionally, I was on the independently owned Coventry Journal, and we used to outscoot the Coventry Evening Telegraph and the Birmingham Post and Mail and BBC Midlands, and you know, almost every week, you know, with good stories. Because see, the other thing is, a lot of people won't go to established publications. They don't think they're going to be taken seriously.
No, that's right. Well, this is a self-censorship kind of thing, isn't it?
You've
got this thing called the Bristolian. And generally speaking, if you chuck an interesting story that's been spiked by the big guys their way, you'll find it in the next edition. Anyway, look, Chris, you're still a member of the NUJ, are you?
Yes. I've always been a member of the NUJ. In fact, I was supposed to have got my gold badge at the 101st delegate annual conference, but that's all got lost in the system somewhere.
Oh, so you haven't had it yet?
No, I haven't. I tackled the general secretary at the time. He said he just says NUJ incompetence, and the next year after that, and I just gave up.
Well, I don't think you should. I think you're entitled to it. Anyway, look, Chris Hewitt, lovely to speak to you again. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.